The date is June 8th, 1984, and we're watching Ghostbusters. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Dr. Peter Venkman to my Dr. Egon Spangler.
Man, get on you for not just giving me the black guy.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
Well, yeah, Winston is... He just seems like such a minor character compared to the other ones. And I know in my reading, I definitely discovered that originally they wanted Winston to be played by Eddie Murphy. And he would have had a much bigger part if he was played by Eddie Murphy. He would have joined them as soon as they went to the hotel to catch Slimer. And my thought is, well, what a kick in the nuts for Ernie Hudson with the fact that they're like, well, it's not Eddie Murphy anymore. Let's bring him in later then.
Yeah.
You know? Well, this week we are celebrating the long awaited release of Ghostbusters Afterlife. I know we have moved this episode a few times now. Thank you very much. I don't even know. I guess this is a Columbia picture, isn't it? But We decided to bring in a guest, and so you may have heard him this summer in Paw Patrol the movie, just like I did, where he was playing Ryder. Please welcome back our friend Will Brisbane. Will, welcome back.
It's good to be back, gentlemen. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, as always, a pleasure. Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, a big one this week. I worry about touching the ones that are like such iconic movies.
But totally. Here we are.
This week, we're looking back at June 1984 when the movies in theaters were Gremlins, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Top Secret, and of course, our movie for today, Ghostbusters, which earned $295.2 million on a $30 million budget.
And of course, if you don't want to get slimed with spoilers, then hit pause, go watch the movie, and come back and hear what we have to say.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie as well, I have several once again. First, they're here to save the world.
Okay.
Second, coming to save the world this summer. A huge difference, right?
I don't like save the world. Like, saving the world isn't the tagline that I think of when I think of Ghostbusters.
Yeah. No, it's just such a stereotypical tagline.
Well, here we go with tagline number three. They ain't afraid of no ghost.
Well, that's the moneymaker.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I hear they're here to save the world. I immediately think B-movie. Like, it's not going to be very good. But if I see they ain't afraid of no ghost, I'm like, okay, this has some potential.
Okay. Well, number four, who you going to call? Ghostbusters.
I like that, too.
Yeah. Five, the supernatural spectacular.
That could be anything. That could be any Halloween movie.
Yeah. Number six, we're ready to believe you.
Like, I mean, it's a line from the movie, like the commercial. So, I mean, it makes sense that it would be the tagline, like in all the advertising. I don't know. It just doesn't land as well as the...
Yeah, well, finally, the bragging one of the group, the world's most successful comedy. I feel like that one was probably on a re-release or something, but...
Right.
But they may not be the best descriptions of this movie, so let's go to Colin and do a 60-second synopsis. If it's needed. I mean, it's Ghostbusters.
Yeah, it was pretty difficult to, like, do a 60-second synopsis for this movie, given that probably, like, it's... Well, I mean, to be fair, I hadn't watched this movie until about, like, 5 years ago, so...
Okay. Yeah.
All right. When paranormal researchers Peter Venkman, Ray Stantz, and I wrote Aaron Spangler, but that's Egon Spangler. Autocorrect got the best of me. Are fired from their jobs at Columbia University. They put on their entrepreneur hats and decide to double down on going into the ghost business. Together, they establish the Ghostbusters and use their skills to investigate and eliminate paranormal activity wherever it may be found. Once they amass some notoriety, they decide to make a diversity hire and hire Winston Zeddemore to join the team. When a spirit named Zool possesses the apartment of Dana Barrett, she hires the Ghostbusters to intervene. Venkman, who will do anything to get laid, takes a special interest in Dana and her case and vows to help her out, but not before she becomes possessed by Zool itself. Something is very wrong in the neighborhood. Who you gonna call? Let's find out on another episode of... I used to like this one.
My autocorrect problem that I had is it changed Egon to economics. Yeah, so, I mean, come on, Ghostbusters. I love Ghostbusters. I've always loved Ghostbusters. And there we go. Will, what is your history with Ghostbusters since, you know, you are a whole you younger than us and then some?
Totally. So I grew up, my family, we were always super into movies. So Ghostbusters was one of the first movies I remember watching. I was probably 8 or 9 the first time I watched it, you know. So okay. I was like fully conscious, and it was the first movie that I could tell, like, okay, I really like this movie. And yeah, I watch it every year. It's a great Halloween movie. And sometimes throughout the year, I give myself excuses to watch it again. But yeah, it's totally super great. And it was such a pleasure to get to watch it again for today.
Yeah. Now, do you have a relationship with Ghostbusters 2 between the two? I mean, like...
Of all the Ghostbusters media created, it's one of them. It's a movie. It's a movie that I've seen. I don't really have an opinion on it. It's just kind of meh. Like, I don't hate it because it's Ghostbusters. It's fun. It's just, it's not as good as I had hoped.
Yeah. Well, now I'm gonna throw some dynamite in the bonfire here, and I'm just gonna say it. I don't hate the Melissa McCarthy Ghostbusters. And I'm gonna back up from my mic here and make sure I actually don't hate that movie. I mean, I love all the Ghostbusters. Obviously, there is a hierarchy, and this is the top one out of all of the Ghostbusters, but yeah, I kind of like what they did with the woman one.
Yeah, it wasn't terrible. It definitely followed it had a really good structure, and I really liked how they did a lot of it, and obviously, Melissa McCarthy is so funny, so she definitely brought that one up many, many notches.
Chris Hemsworth was the funny one in that movie.
Oh my god, he killed me.
Colin, what about you? You say you only saw it for the first time about 5 years ago. So what's your story with Ghostbusters?
Well, yeah, Ghostbusters, what, like, they were both Ghostbusters 1 and 2 came out before when I was very young. My family wasn't really into those movies, so I never had any cause to watch them, I guess. My introduction to Ghostbusters is actually through the cartoon show, the real Ghostbusters. That was all I actually ever even knew of Ghostbusters, and I remember having a bunch of the toys and all that stuff. But that was really my only touch with Ghostbusters.
I remember one where you, like, pushed a lever or squeezed their legs and their eyes
out. Yeah, I remember I had a bunch of those. And then I remember 2012, 13... somewhere around there, I was working at, it's gone now, but it used to be in West Edmonton Mall. It was called Collector's Edge, and it was like a collectible toy store. And people would just always come in and, like, buy Ghostbusters merch. Like, people just, like, went crazy for Ghostbusters stuff, and I never really understood it. I mean, I get, like, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man looks, like, cool, and there was something with that. But I just, it was one of those ones where as much as I have gotten by of kind of knowing where pop culture references come from, Ghostbusters had always kind of been a blind spot for me, and so I just decided to watch the movies. But I actually only got through Ghostbusters. I never watched Ghostbusters 2. And then when the Melissa McCarthy one, what do they call it now? It was
Answer the Call.
Yeah, when it was released, though, it was just called Ghostbusters. It's, like, been retroactively called Answer the Call, right?
I'm
clear on that.
It feels like it. Or they leaned into it. It's kind of like how Star Wars suddenly became Star Wars Episode 4, you know, A New Hope, you know? Like, that's how it feels, yeah.
Yeah, so I remember watching that movie in the theaters, and I mean, I didn't think it was, like, anything to write home about, but there was definitely parts of it that made me laugh out loud in the theater. Yeah. So I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's about it. That's the only The cartoon, like I said, that's my main touch with Ghostbusters, and then the newer movie.
Yeah.
I didn't know that the 2016 Ghostbusters was now called Answer the Call. I didn't.
Yeah.
Well, it's Ghostbusters : Answer the Call. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I must say I am looking forward to a Paul Rudd, Wolf Finhart version of this movie.
With
yeah.
the old people.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
I hope so. I mean, I've been waiting long enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters is one of those things, though, for me, as someone who has never... It's like, people talk about it with such reverence. You know what I mean? It's one of those movies where I'm like... I mean, I guess Will's a lot younger than us, and he enjoyed it, but I thought... Even watching it this go around, I was kind of just like, is it that good? I don't know. Bill Murray's awesome, obviously, but
yeah.
He's also kind of weird in this movie, so.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, let's jump into Ghostbusters, directed and produced by Ivan Reitman and written by Harold Ramis, Dan Aykroyd, and an uncredited Rick Moranis. I have a feeling that's just because he improvised nearly everything he did in the movie. I think that's why he's given a writing credit, but it's uncredited. But yeah, like that whole speech where he's in his apartment, that is all Rick Moranis, about like the salmon and the sale price that he got. It's from Nova Scotia, Canada. And yeah, all of that is like, they kind of gave him beats to hit, and everything yeah. else is filled in by him.
Wow.
Yeah, he's great in this movie.
Oh, Rick Moranis, he's amazing in everything. Come on, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah, even when this movie gets like into the weird, he's still so good. The whole gatekeeper thing, I really liked it.
Oh, I love the part where he's in the firehouse and, you know, like looking at the cheese balls and the
yeah,
and like picking everything up and looking at it, handing Egon the lamp.
Oh man.
Well, we open this movie in the New York Public Library, where strange things are afoot in the basement. And there are moments in this movie where I absolutely love the special effects. Like, I think the librarian ghost still holds up, and the practical things of moving the books across the aisle and everything like that. Like, I love this opening, but then you get to, like, the terror dogs later on, where it's just like, ooh, those ones are really rough.
When the one dog jumps out of the hallway, that was some ugly special effects. But I mean, 1984, like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
yeah, I thought the opening special effects were awesome. Like, I was just the practicality of it, like, however they're doing that with the air pressure or whatever to make the cue cards fly out. I was like, that would have been so much fun to film, I think.
Yeah.
to actually have it happening rather than them just CGIing it now like they probably would.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, yeah, the practical effects are great. And, like, the way that they do the ghosts, I mean, Slimer still holds up really well. Or I guess Onion Head was the name that he had on set. But thanks to the cartoon that Colin cherishes so much, yeah, he is forever going to be Slimer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually a really huge disconnect with me between when I watch this movie, is like, in the cartoon, Slimer is kind of like Orko in He-Man. Like, he's part of the team. And in this movie, he's kind of just like a small, like, he's a really small part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Slimer didn't get enough respect.
Does he become a bigger part of it in the second movie, or is he even there?
No, he shows up like a cameo in the second movie.
Okay.
It's like a callback of, oh, there's Slimer again. Yeah, I mean, the second movie, if you haven't seen that one, you're not missing a whole lot.
Yeah, but it's just average.
Yeah, but there's more actual relationships, more banter between the characters, because you're not building up this whole story where they're separated at first in this, right? I mean, you know, it starts off with Venkman doing his ESP scam. Is that the word I'm looking for? His scam that he's got going on?
Yeah, I mean, even though the guy, like, was getting paid, I feel like to get tased as part of a university study by your professor is a little bit of a human rights violation.
Yeah, but I love that his line is, you can keep the $5, I've had it. Like, he's getting paid $5, like, I love that. I mean, $5. Adjusted for inflation, maybe that's 20, you know, like... Peter Venkman, though, I mean, Bill Murray seems like the no-brainer, but I read that John Belushi, Michael Keaton, Chevy Chase, Steve Guttenberg, Tom Hanks, and Robin Williams were all possibles for Peter Venkman. And it's like, you know, it's Bill Murray. It's gotta be Bill Murray.
Yeah.
I wonder what Chevy Chase would have been like.
Yeah.
Could have been interesting.
Steve Guttenberg, that's like, that's Short Circuit dude, right? In like Police Academy.
Yeah.
He probably would have been okay, but yeah, it's hard to like not see Bill Murray in that role.
Yeah, absolutely not. Well, I mean, the only actual Ghostbuster that seems like it was cast no matter what was Ray. Was going to be Dan Aykroyd no matter what. I mean, he was writing the
part. Yeah.
But even Egon, Harold Ramis was originally just going to write the movie.
And really? So...
Yeah, Michael Keaton, Christopher Walken, John Lithgow, Christopher Lloyd, and Jeff Goldblum were all possibilities for Egon.
Jeff Goldblum could have been cool. Like, yeah, that, like out of the names you just listed, he's the only one that really caught my eye as like, oh, I could actually see that. That could be interesting.
But you don't want a Christopher Walken Egon.
That,
I mean, that's
was
my...
Was that a Christopher Walken
No, no, I guess it wasn't. But I've got one voice that I do. My only voice is Kermit the Frog. That's kind of all I've got is...
Yeah.
It would appear I've got a frog in my throat. That's my impression. Go. Yeah, but other than that, no. I wish I could do a Christopher Walken. But see, it ends up like that.
Will, can you do a Walken?
I can try. I can try. Your father's watch, he stored it up his ass. And now...
you're turning British.
Yeah,
you're
turning British.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It started off okay, and then it kind of train...
Now, imagine a Twinkie, and the Twinkie is 35 feet long, or whatever. No, the size of football fields? I don't know.
I feel like you always have to... I always go to the... I don't even know if I can... I always think of, like, in Catch Me If You Can when he's doing the mouse, and he's always like, I had a cat, and I heard a story about a guy, and there was a mouse... And he can't do, and I'm just like, I can't do it. I like ghosts. Ghosts are good.
Yeah, see? Yeah.
It's tough.
Props to anyone that can do a Christopher Walken.
Yeah, he's got a very distinct voice.
Yeah. Well, since I'm talking about alternate castings as well, for Winston, on top of Eddie Murphy, Reginald Vell Johnson was also a possibility. And he does get his, like, 5 seconds of fame in this movie as the prison guard. He did make it into the movie, but yeah, Carl Winslow could have been Winston.
I don't know how I would feel if I went, like, it must be hard to go to audition for, like, a really big role, but get cast in, like... a little part like that, and then watch it and then be like, oh, like, you could have been the one of the Ghostbusters that everybody talks about.
But
now we'll just remember you for being the prison guard.
Yeah, well, because there's a second case of that in this movie. Walter Peck, who was played by William Atherton, who we saw in Die Hard, he could have been played by Michael Ensign, who ended up getting cast as the manager of the Sedgwick Hotel.
Mm.
So that could have been Peck, though.
I don't know, like, trying to picture Peck as, like, an older dude.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
So, yeah, so we our Ghostbusters show up at the library to check everything out, and just like I said back in My Stepmother is an Alien, boy, is Dan Aykroyd good at spouting out scientific jargon. Because, like, you know, the whole opening scene, I mean, Bill Murray gets lines like, Alice, are you at this moment menstruating? But it's Dan Aykroyd that is talking about all the EKG readings and everything like that when he comes to collect Peter Venkman at his ESP study.
Yeah.
I wonder if he just watches, like, a lot of, I guess he wouldn't have had YouTube back then.
Yeah.
Maybe he would just watched a lot of, I don't know. I don't even know what would have been around. There wasn't even, like, a 24-hour news cycle back then.
Yeah. Yeah, bunch of documentaries on videotape or something. I mean, yeah. I've heard that these days Dan Aykroyd is really into, like, aliens and stuff.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah, I mean, I've heard that about him. So, I mean, maybe he does and always has watched a lot of those shows.
Well, I know he did write Ghostbusters because he was very into ghosts. And I feel like the natural progression from ghosts is to aliens, so.
Yeah.
Right.
In the scene where they go down to the basement to investigate, did you know that the falling bookcase was an accident?
No.
Yeah, when that bookcase falls, it was never supposed to happen. And so they just went with it where it's, you know, has that ever happened to you before? No, first time? Yeah, like they just went with it. But yeah, that bookcase wasn't supposed to fall.
Yeah, they played it off perfectly.
Yeah. But one thing I don't get is the symmetrical book stacking.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Okay, first of all, the books don't actually look like they're completely symmetrical. They're all off kilter. But I don't understand how this is a paranormal event. I've never understood how...
Well, I mean, like, stacking books, like, if you've ever tried, like, it is insanely hard. Like, and I think they mentioned that it, like, couldn't have been humans, or they say it was humans or something. I don't remember the exact line, but, like, trying to stack books, like, it's an actual, it's a chore for sure. So for there to be, like, 70 perfectly stacked, I feel like that's got to say something.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I mean, the ghost is a librarian, though, so she'd be, like, an expert in all things book stacking, I feel.
Yeah, I guess
that makes sense.
It just doesn't necessarily, I don't look at a pile of books and go, whew, only a ghost could have done that. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, right? I see.
Yeah. But we get one of my favorite lines, Egon, you're mucus. But yes, and then of course Ray comes up with the master plan of get her. I've never understood why he doesn't let them in on the plan. Like, I guess that's just the joke, but it's like
I just never understood the plan. Like, if they're like experts in ghosts, and like the theory is that, like, you know, ghosts can pass through us and like solid objects, I don't know how they would hypothetically get her.
Oh yeah,
are they so like at this point, I know they're like paranormal researchers or whatever, but is this the first time that they see a ghost? Like, have they encountered ghosts before, or is it all up to this point, is it all just theoretical?
I think they've never seen one like up close, but like they've investigated like different strange occurrences.
Yeah.
Like I remember watching Unsolved Mysteries back in the day, and whenever they had a ghost story, it was always about like you'd see like they always had like the, it was like supernatural almost, like they had like the EMF readers, and they had they would look for like the little lights in the cameras and stuff. And I feel that's kind of how I feel like they were probably before they actually saw the real ghost. So it makes sense that it's like they probably weren't even expecting to find anything.
Yeah.
But I mean, you should have a better plan than just try to catch a non-corporeal being.
Yeah, probably. Well, I've always laughed at the thing that Peter takes to Dana's apartment with the little like rubber bulb and the tube, and he's just going around pumping the rubber bulb. And I've always wondered what that was. And I found out that it's like it's a sniffer that's used to locate utility gas leaks. I've never known what this is, and at this point I don't understand what it would be looking for in this case.
Well, maybe he was trying to see if there was a gas leak in case it was like affecting what she saw or something.
Oh, okay, that works for me.
Yeah, because like because I had a feeling that was it, because of the questions he was asking to the librarian about, like, asking the questions to see if she would just be delirious or something.
That makes sense. Yeah. I was going to say, you're giving the producers too much credit. I was like, they probably just banked on nobody knowing what that thing was. So it could just be like, he could just at some point be like, oh, this thing, it's my ghost detector. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, you know, but it's not nearly as scientific as the pole at the fire hall. I love that line. Does this pole still work? I mean, if it doesn't, you're dead, aren't you?
Yeah.
I was going to say, there is the point where they come down the pole where it doesn't look the most stable. It seems kind of shaky.
Yeah.
And then when Ray goes down, it like it's like got chip paint and stuff, and it wobbles a lot. So I'm like, how did he not get like slivers or like cut or anything? And how did he not die?
Yeah. Well, and I do have to laugh. We talked about Dana a second ago, where it's just like checking to see if the possible client is crazy. It's like, you should be happy that you have a client at all. But there is the scene where they're sitting around eating their Chinese food dinner, and you know, and Peter's like, oh, I should take some petty cash and take her out to dinner and all that sort of thing. Oh, this is the last of our petty cash. And my thought is, well, you've got pinball machines in the background. How can you afford a pinball machine if this is the last of your cash right here? You know, they don't have their priorities straight.
Yeah.
They're defunct pinball machines. They're just for play.
Yeah. Well, it is a real pinball machine, though. In fact, it's a pinball machine called Star Castle. And, well, that means it's time for Sponsorship Corner! So, always on the lookout for product placements in movies, this week, Ghostbusters is brought to you by the pinball machine Star Castle, Hostess Twinkies, Nestle Crunch, Nutri-Grain, Cheez-Its, and Hi-Ho Crackers, Oscar Mayer Lunch Meat, Wise Potato Chips, Wishbone Dressing, Coke and Tab Cola, Perrier Water, Hiram Walker Apricot Brandy, Budweiser Beer, Cuisinart, Panasonic, Lacoste, AVL Electronics, Con Edison, the American Red Cross, the Essex House, People Time, Omni, and Atlantic Magazines, and the newspapers USA Today, the New York Post, and the Globe. Plus, the fictional Manhattan City Bank, Sedgwick Hotel, Ghostbusters Incorporated, and of course, Stay Puffed Marshmallows. And this has been Sponsorship Corner. I read that with those Stay Puffed Marshmallow, man, they made 3 suits, and they cost $20,000 each.
Wow.
Just to go up in flames.
That's wild.
I've read a thing that was talking about how, like, the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man is, like, one of the first big screen kaiju monsters. Like, okay. From, like a god, like Godzilla or King Kong and all those, like, Pacific Rim and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was always like, man, it would be sweet to see Godzilla versus Stay Puffed.
Yeah.
What I never understood about the whole Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man was, like, they were talking, like, it was, like, whatever they thought about it would appear as. And then he says the line, you think about so-and-so, so-and-so will try and kill us. But by saying that, wouldn't he be thinking about, like, I don't remember the exact person.
J. Edgar Hoover, I think it is.
Yeah. But by saying the line about J. Edgar Hoover, wouldn't he have J. Edgar Hoover in his mind?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't really understand that, but the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man's so iconic, you can't really diss it.
Yeah. Well, and I love how they actually build a world around Stay Puft Marshmallows. Because, like, when Dana gets her groceries home,
she has a
pack of Stay Puft Marshmallows. There is the part when Peck turns off the power to the containment unit and the roof blows up. In the background, painted on one of the buildings, you can see a Stay Puft Marshmallow ad. I like the attention to making sure that they make this canon for the universe. And I must say that the trailers for the new movie with the mini Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man scene, that's a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to that.
Totally.
Yeah, I never even noticed, like, half the stuff you just mentioned, but I appreciate that, like, build up. Because I was watching it, and I was kind of like, it's like, I think I saw one reference, so I was like, okay, that's funny. But I didn't realize that they've kind of, they lay the seeds all the way through.
Yeah, good world building.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about a couple of our side characters. I mean, we've mentioned Dana Barrett, played by Sigourney Weaver. I read that Julia Roberts was a possibility to play Dana Barrett. And, of course, we've also got Rick Moranis playing Louis Tully. I read John Candy was a possibility. And his plan was to make Louis Tully German. Jay Leno read for the part, and Eddie Deason, who I don't really know who that is, was also a possibility. He was Eugene in Greece.
Okay.
So he was a possibility too. But yeah, John Candy was a possibility for Louis Tully, but they didn't like his take on it, and he refused to budge from German Louis.
I don't really like it either. That just sounds... Yeah, I don't know. I can't picture him as German. Like, I feel like John Candy, if he would have done it, you know, the John Candy way, It would have been cool, but, like, I don't know. German, I just can't see the character as that.
Yeah, I don't like the German thing, but I'm just imagining, like, John Candy from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, or the John Candy that shows up in Home Alone.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
That guy would have been, I mean, Rick Moranis, I think, is still, he was awesome, but I think that version of John Candy would have been equally as funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think, you know, like, they both have big parts, but Dana Barrett and Lewis, I feel like they just should have had bigger parts. Like, they were obviously in a good chunk of it, but they were, like, so funny, and they brought up the movie so much. I just, yeah, especially Dana. She didn't really get a lot of good moments, but, yeah, she definitely should have got the spotlight a little bit more.
I found Dana very confusing and, like, a real victim of, I don't know how to, what you'd call it, but like the 80s female stereotype.
Yeah.
What is her relation? She has basically no relationship to Peter at all. Like, they're not together.
Yeah.
In any capacity, but all of a sudden she just becomes like the damsel in distress.
Yeah.
Overnight, and then even they're like, I was watching it and they're, I was surprised first at the end when they kiss.
Yeah.
But then it's also so awkward. Like, I almost feel like Sigourney Weaver in that moment on film is like, this doesn't make any sense. I don't know why we just did this.
Yeah. Well, I thought it actually almost looked like Bill Murray was forcing the kiss off.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, it's like, oh, I've got this brilliant idea. I will make you kiss me in this final scene. That's almost how it felt. Yeah,
I didn't even feel like it seemed like she was into him at all before she like saw him in the courtyard doing his little kick thing or whatever. Like, and even after that, it just seemed like she was like kind of repelled.
Yeah, she's kind of bullied into taking the date with him.
Yeah,
he's a very questionable character, that's for sure. When it comes to that.
Also, I did mess up a little bit when I said about Lewis and Dana having bigger parts. I meant Lewis and Janine.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Janine as well.
I had Dane in my head and then I just said that. So, no, I meant to say Janine because she was funny.
Yeah.
Janine played by Annie Potts. Sandra Bernhardt, if you know that comedian, she was a possibility to play Janine. I can't see anyone else in Janine, though. I love Annie Potts in this.
Yeah, she was pretty great.
Yeah,
and she's reprising her role in Afterlife, I heard.
Oh, nice.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, she does. I've seen her in the trailer. She's the one person they have shown in the trailer.
Right. I thought they showed Bill Murray at the end of the...
You see, like, his hand in the back of his head or something like that. I don't think they've actually fully shown him yet.
But it's him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have liked more Lewis just to kind of... I think the thing I like about Lewis, every time he's on screen, I feel like it something is happening. Like, something... Like, it's... It's just, it lifts up the movie. There are points in this movie that I find just dragged so much. Like, it just slowed down too much where I was just like, okay, look, next, let's move on. Let's move on
to the next thing.
But I thought anytime Rick Moranis was on screen, I was interested. I think Dana should have became Zool earlier, too.
Yeah. Well, absolutely ironic that he does become the Keymaster, but he gets locked out of his apartment 3 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was. I wonder if that was intentional, because that was pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, is the whole Keymaster and Gatekeeper thing, is that all, like, double entendre going on there?
Probably. But okay. With these guys, I'm going to say sure.
Right.
Knowing who wrote it, I'm going to say, yeah, probably. Yeah.
Now, with Lewis, I do want to say, though, with him getting chased across the park with the dog and ending up outside the window of that restaurant, how does no one see what's going on when that happens? He screams and then he, like, slides out of shot, but it's all windows. How does no one see him actually being attacked by something?
How I saw it, like, when he was pounding on the glass and stuff, it seemed like a higher end establishment, and he was like, his clothes were all tattered and stuff, so how I saw it was like they were looking at him as like, you know, just some crazy homeless person, and then they weren't even gonna, they were just giving him the cold shoulder.
Yeah, I don't know, I just feel like you, even with a someone like that, someone would have seen him getting dragged away is all I'm thinking. It was all glass.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about their first ghost when they go to the Sedgwick Hotel and they see Slimer. I've always loved some of the moments in this scene. I think one of my favorites, the waiting for the elevator part, where they say, we're exterminators. Someone saw a cockroach up on 12. And then they get in the elevator and they turn on their packs for the first time. And I just love the subtle moment where Peter and Egon, like, move over as far as they can to the side of the elevator.
Yeah.
I like this scene. It's probably my favorite ghost catching scene in the movie. I just, a lot of good banter between the characters, and you know, Slimer's just, obviously he's Slimer, but my favorite, not favorite part of the scene, but a part that I really liked is like outside the room, like what's going on with the manager and all the guests and stuff. I just thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, the ballroom scene, guys, I've just sent you each something, and I think it's time to put our voice actor friend to work here. And do a little I used to like this One Piece theater.
Heck yeah.
Okay, guys, I have sent you the script for the ballroom scene because, I mean, come on, it's Ghostbusters, and this has some of the best lines in here. Let's see, who wants who?
Hang on, I'm just opening this up.
So, yeah, we've got the scene between Egon, Ray, and Peter.
Well, I mean, you guys go first. I'm the guest. You guys should get first choice.
Oh, well, I'll take Egon. I'll take Egon.
All right.
All right. I'll be Ray.
You'll be Ray? Okay.
Peter.
There are a couple moments in this script where the hotel manager shows up. We'll just skip over those parts. We'll do everything that happens in the room. The room where it happened.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so...
So I'm Ray, starting at like, okay, sir.
And yeah, then yeah.
We're, okay.
And then, yeah, there it is on the ceiling. Okay.
Okay. Okay, sir. If you and your staff could please wait out here, we'll take care of everything. There it is, on the ceiling.
That's the one that got me.
All right, boys. Ready? Throw it! I did that! That's my fault!
It's okay. The table broke the fall.
There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
What?
Don't cross the streams.
Why?
It would be bad.
I'm fuzzy on the whole good-bad thing. What do you mean, bad?
Try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total protonic reversal.
Right. That's bad. Okay, important safety tip. Thanks, Egon. All right, Ray, take the left. Egon, take the right. Okay, Ray, give me one eye on the outside. Ray! Egon! Okay, all right, hold it. Hold it. Whoa! Nice shooting, Tex.
The last throw took something out of him, but he's gonna move. I need some room to put the trap down. Give me some room. We gotta get this in the clear.
Wait. I've always wanted to do this. And the flowers are still standing.
Okay, on my go signal. Spangler, I want a confinement stream from you, okay? Go! Okay, hold him up there. He's gonna move. Hold him up. Go!
It's working, Ray!
Start bringing him down! You got him! Don't cross the stream!
Maybe now you'll never slam a guy with a positron collider, huh?
Bankman, shorten your stream. I don't want my face burned off.
Alright, I'm opening the trap now. Don't look directly into the trap.
I looked at the trap, Ray.
Turn your streams off as soon as I close the trap. Get ready! I'm closing it now!
It's in there.
Hey!
Well, that wasn't such a chore now, was it?
We came! We saw! We kicked its ass!
Yes! I used to like this One Piece theater!
Da-da-da.
Yes!
I've got a whole lot of special sound effects that I have to find now.
There's one part where my delivery is way off for what the scene is for. I forgot that I was too slow reading the stage directions.
So yeah, any 80s movie, I mean, we get montages. I've read that the montages were some of the first things that they decided to film for this movie, and they did it largely without permits.
Yeah. So,
Like, it would be interesting, some of these things that you hear about where they're doing it without permits. Like, Taxi Driver is a famous one that they were trying to film without permits. But, like, can you imagine something like Ghostbusters where you're running around in the Ghostbusters outfit?
In New York? Like,
no, I mean, I could see getting away with, like, a small indie movie that was, like, very personal. And you mean, like, nowadays if you were filming it with, like, when people film it with their iPhones or whatnot?
Yeah.
But I feel like you'd have to be pretty fast. Yeah. Especially in, where is this movie filmed?
New York.
New York, yeah. Yeah. Like, I feel... And I'm betting New York costs, like, a lot of money to film in. But
probably, if you get proper permits.
Yeah.
I mean, they did that for Elf as well, is they just had Will Ferrell running around in his Elf costume.
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's the one guy that gets angry at him coming across the street, and that's not an actor. That was some guy that he went up to and tried to hug, and the guy actually got pissed off at him.
Oh, no. Borat.
That's the Borat filming style is what that is.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
But in the montage, I remember the first time that I realized what was actually going on with Ray's belt and pants being unzipped. But as we saw in My Stepmother is an Alien, Ice Going Crossed is kind of Dan Aykroyd's go-to sex move, isn't it?
I guess maybe that's just how he experiences pleasure. I don't know.
Yeah, just eyes crossing.
Has their own thing.
But I read, though, that this ghost blowjob scene was actually part of a longer scene that was originally filmed where they went to, like, a historic fort. So that's why, like, Ray is in a weird outfit. He's actually in, like, an RCMP outfit.
Really?
And I want to know the context of this scene. Like, it's just, you know, like...
Yeah.
Maybe they were at, like, they took a trip to Fort Edmonton Park or something to do. There was an old-timey ghost in the whatever that... What's that hotel there called?
The Selkirk.
Selkirk Hotel. Selkirk.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about Zool and Gozer and the whole big reason why we're here in this movie. I did read that Gozer... was at one point they tried to get Paul Rubens to play the part. And then Zool, they wanted a punk rocker Anne Carlisle to play Zool. Of course, the voice of Zool is done by Ivan Reitman.
Oh, so really?
When Dana talks, there is no Dana, only Zool. Yeah, that's Ivan Reitman. That was better than my Christopher Walken impression.
At least give me
that. Yeah, one.
That was good. I'll give you a slow cap.
I'll give you that.
It's funny, I did read, though, that there was even a theme song possibility. You know, the Ray Parker Jr. theme song. Originally, they approached Huey Lewis in the News to do it.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah, and also Lindsey Buckingham, who you may know as the one from Vacation that sang
Holiday Road. Holiday Road. Holiday Road. Yeah.
But she decided not to do it because she didn't want to become, like, you know, typecast as a movie theme song singer. So
I mean, that kind of makes sense, I guess.
Yeah. There are worse things to be typecast as, Lindsay.
Yeah. Pretty much. But yeah, so I know that scene where Dana at her apartment gets attacked by the chair with the hands coming out of it. I mean, one of them is getting really handsy with her. I gotta say that. And I mean, like, no pun intended, but one of them really gets a fistful of Sigourney there. But that scene has always been one that I find legitimately creepy in this movie. Out of everything, like, when I was younger, that one was a little traumatic to me.
Right.
But you can totally see the track on the floor that the chair goes off in.
I didn't notice that, but I'll have to look for that.
Yeah, I didn't notice it either.
Well, it's the way the tiles are placed. You can tell that the line for the tiles is where they hid the track to be able to pull the chair into the kitchen.
Yes. I think the scene where she gets possessed by Zool or whatever is my favorite scene in the movie. Or, like, one of the funniest scenes in the movie when she's, like, in her bedroom or whatever, and Venkman comes and opens the door, and it's all like, ah! She's yeah. like, blah, blah, blah. And then she's like, are you the gatekeeper? And he's like, no, and the door just closes.
Yeah.
And then he opens it up and does the same thing. So funny. Great segue.
Yes, I am the key master. Yeah. Well, okay, here's one thing, though, that actually only hit me on this particular watch. Is there is the part where he calls back to the station and they've got the keymaster with them there and they're talking to him with his colander on the head. But Peter says that he has knocked her out with 300 cc's of Thorazine. So this leads me to believe that Peter Venkman is just carrying around a syringe full of Thorazine on a date night. I mean, I assume it's a syringe because they said CCs.
Right.
After I realized this in my like in my own notes and in my own head of, wait a minute, that means he was carrying around something to drug her with. I read that Thorazine had been used in cases of date rape in the 80s, which makes it extra questionable.
That's bad.
That Peter Venkman going over there for a date was carrying around a date rape drug.
Yeah, that's not good.
I mean, is it good? No, but it is kind of par for the course. Like, I think that Peter Venkman is an incredibly problematic character by today's standards. Like, I don't think he could be that way anymore. Like, he's literally all about, like, even from the first time you meet him when he's doing the little card thing
with the students,
he's just all about like manipulating people, specifically women, to try and get with them. And then I mean, the idea that he has a date rape drug going to this woman that he's barely met, how is it not overly surprising given his track record?
Yeah, and then he leaves her and like kisses her like on the neck or shoulder or whatever,
which is also, that was like, awkward,
a very intimate type place to kiss someone if this is your first date with someone that didn't even like you much in the first place.
Yeah,
he's got all the funniest lines. He is definitely a questionable character, like you said.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, like, in 2020, like, because I feel like Peter Venkman is one of those characters where back in the day when this movie came out, people probably look at him like, oh, like, that's a man. He's a man's man. And, like, everybody wants, he's the cool guy. Everybody wants to be like him.
Yeah.
But now he's kind of like, I was watching this movie and I was just like, he's creepy. He kind of creeps me out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, the manliest man's man in this movie, I would say, is Winston Zeddemore.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he's the no nonsense, like, you know. When I took this job, I didn't believe any of it. But since I took this job, I've seen shit that would make you turn white. You know, like, he's got all his lines like that. But, I mean, like, yeah, he's probably the toughest guy. And he's got some great lines. I wish they had used Winston more. Because, like, when he's on the roof saying, this ain't worth $11.5 a year. Like, it's just, you know, it's like, oh, that's wonderful. I took that to the inflation calculator, though. That's a $28,952 job
that he's working.
Not too bad.
Well, you're 16, so that's not too bad.
Okay. But...
yeah, for me, that's like, ooh, ouch. That's poverty right there.
Right. Gee whiz. No, the whole how Winston joins the team, I did not like that. Like, how he just came for the job and they just said, you got it. Like I understand why, and I understand how it needed to progress the story. I just felt like there could have been, you know, a good interview segment that could have been funny.
Well, I take it more as he was probably the only guy that showed up for the job. That's how I've always interpreted
it.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, you know, you've got a pulse and you're here willing to work the job. You've got the job, you know. I mean, he's the only one that's not actually a doctor. He's just, nope, I need a job.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with Will. I felt like it was too, it just happens.
Yeah.
And it's hard because, like, he doesn't, I feel like that's why Winston is kind of always the one who's, like, left out.
Yeah.
He's not part of the in-group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or whatever. He's just kind of like the add-on guy, and it does seem very, it just seemed really thrown together. Like, he didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he's not like super integral to anything that like happens after he joins the team from what I can remember, but mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, then why have him there anyways? Just because quartets are better than trios, or
yeah.
Oh, if it was the 90s, there would have been five, because, you know, every boy band needs five members. So.
Well, I mean, exactly. Like, the idea of having the Eddie Murphy script where he would have been introduced before they even went to get Slimer, that's something where it's like, okay, we need a fourth person. And having him as part of more of those. But once Winston gets introduced, he's part of one of the montages, you know, and he's there for the one speech with Ray about, do you believe in God? He very underused. And I've always been such a Winston fan because he is the man's man. He's the window for the audience at how ridiculous this could be.
Totally.
In a way, you know?
Yeah, I get that.
And unfortunately, because of the way he's introduced, he's always just felt like the token black guy. And so,
yeah.
At least in Ghostbusters 2, he is expanded as a character and he's there from the beginning. But yeah, I mean, just this, it's like, I've always thought Winston was done dirty.
Yeah, I agree. Especially how they changed it for Ernie Hudson when it would have been Eddie Murphy with more screen time. How they changed it just because it was Ernie Hudson. That's some backstabment if I've ever heard it.
Yeah.
That's some systemic racism. And that was your woke moment.
There you go.
I kind of find all the characters like a little bit one dimensional.
Yeah.
Right.
I feel like each of them just like they play their role, but you never really get like to see deeper into them.
There's not
especially
a lot of like
Venkman, I find.
Yeah, especially Venkman. There's not a lot of motivation. I almost feel like you kind of said, Sean, like the perfect role for Winston would be to be the audience's eyes into these characters. But by the time he shows up, they're just on the go. Like, it's just that they just, like, do the montage, and then they're, like, straight into, we have to go battle Zool and
the
Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and all that.
Yeah.
It would have been a little bit nicer to even get a glimpse into, like, what is the relate? Like, these guys are all clearly, like, co-workers, friends, like, and seemingly have been for a while, but you don't really get to know what their relationship is.
Yeah, did they just all end up like in the same department, or do they have more of a history?
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously, Ray is the one that's just kind of, he's the one that gets dumped on. He's the one that has to take out the extra mortgage.
Yeah, I thought that was nuts. Yeah, that was just a jerk move. And even though they're like, oh, everybody has three mortgages these days.
Yeah. Well, and that's where Egon has some of the best, like, subtle lines, where he's the one that's, like, calculating how much it'll cost, you know, it's like the interest alone on that, you know, and he's sitting there with the calculator. Like, I love some of Egon's subtle moments, or like with the whole ghost, when they're catching Slimer, when he's going down the hallway with like the sensor thing. And he comes to a person and, like, starts scanning him and then, like, pokes him. Like, I that's one of my favorite Egon moments right there.
That was pretty funny.
Okay, so this building, what is up with that rooftop? I mean, they've got, like, a stone bench that's out near the edge and the obelisks and everything like that. I've never understood this rooftop.
Are you talking about, like, where the demon stuff happens
at
the end of the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, same with, like, in Dana's apartment, how all of a sudden there were, like, the stairs with, like, the smoke coming down them and stuff.
Yeah.
The fog and stuff. It just, I don't know, like, you're supposed to suspend disbelief, but I just don't know how supernatural forces could change entire architecture.
Yeah. But even before everything gets changed around at the end there, they show shots of the gargoyles on the roof, like, beforehand. And yeah, there's just like there's these weird obelisks and a bench for some reason. And so it's just a weird rooftop to begin with. And then it transforms even more when the temple is now on the roof. So, but it just, I don't know. I've never understood it. But I did read that this rooftop set, it was built on a soundstage. And to film these scenes, it used so much electricity for those lights that they would actually have to shut down other nearby sound stages to draw from the power grid for these climax scenes.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
I found those to be a very hard watch. It reminded me of like Mystery Men and Batman, where it's like the set just looked too fake. Yeah. I don't know. To me, it looked like it was on a soundstage somewhere. Maybe I'm wrong, or maybe they just dressed it. But it was so boxy and like looked like it was made out of cardboard.
Yeah.
That it was, I don't know. That was one where I was just like, oh, this really doesn't hold up as well as I think people would like.
What's interesting, though, is some of that stuff, like before they go into the building, when the earthquake is happening and the asphalt is all cracking and everything like that, a lot of that was filmed on a soundstage as well. But then they had to like duplicate how things looked outside the building. And apparently it tied up traffic for like most of Manhattan for like the few hours that they had it, that little section of road shut down. It just threw everything off in Manhattan that day. But yeah, they had to like duplicate what was done on the soundstage with the asphalt outside her building.
And
like even Ivan Reitman has gone to say, I can't tell which is which at certain times. So it's like, well, okay, that part at least must have been believable. Yeah. Have you guys seen the movie set that's going on in our city right now, downtown?
Yeah, on Rice Howard Way. It looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
I haven't been downtown in a long time.
I is it The Last of Us that's filming here or something?
I forget what it is. I thought Last of Us was in Calgary.
It is. Wow. But they're according to the news, they're filming some stuff in Edmonton as well on Rice Howard Way and I guess like the Ledge Grounds.
Well, yeah, I'm going to have to drive down there sometime this weekend.
Yeah, so they've got like cars flipped up and I walked past it today and yeah, they've got all these chunks of asphalt everywhere and they've got vines hanging off of them and stuff.
It's pretty rad looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to go check that out.
Right by Scotia Place.
Yeah. Okay.
How did they get blueprints into the prison when they got arrested?
Well, in an unseen scene, they crumpled them up and put them in balloons. And then
they keistered them, huh?
They put in the old meat wallet.
Yeah. I love how everyone in the jail is so enthralled with Egon's story, though, about Gozer and the Sumerians and everything like that. Yeah.
Right.
And then how does the crowd know to gather outside the building? Like, they come racing up, and all of a sudden there's people outside the building, all, you know, police barricaded off. How does everyone know that that's where the Ghostbusters are going?
Yeah.
Yeah,
they just can run really fast behind the Ecto-1.
Yeah. It's funny. Ron Jeremy is in the crowd, though, there. He has a little cameo.
Really?
Yeah.
Did he know somebody in the crew, or did he just happen to be there?
I don't know. Who knows? Yeah, and Debbie Gibson was in the restaurant when Lewis gets attacked by the dog. And Patricia Heaton from Everybody Loves Raymond, she's on the front steps of the library when the Ghostbusters are going in at the beginning. So there's a few cameos for you to watch out for next time you watch Ghostbusters.
Totally.
Yeah.
Nice.
I read that possible alternate title options for this were Ghost Smashers, Ghost Stoppers, Ghost Blasters, or Ghost Breakers. And Ghost Breakers was actually the closest. They even filmed a few alternate scenes, like the scene where they're hanging up the Ghostbusters sign. They filmed that twice. Once was using the Ghost Breakers sign. I guess there was some trademark that someone owned on the Ghostbusters name, and they weren't sure whether they were going to be able to clear it in time for the movie. So they filmed a couple scenes with the Ghost Breakers signs.
Interesting.
Yeah. I also read that during the initial run, they actually came out with a commercial for Ghostbusters to encourage people to go back to the theater and see it. And it was basically the Ghostbusters commercial.
Yeah.
Where it's like the "We're ready to believe you" commercial. And they put a real 1-800 number on the bottom of the screen, and people could phone it, and there would be a recorded message that said, "Hi, you've reached the Ghostbusters. We're out catching ghosts right now." And it got, like, thousands of calls a day.
Oh, my gosh.
It's amazing how bored people get when it comes to, like, a phone number in a movie. It's like, oh, I'm going to call that and check it out.
That's, like, the same thing in Stranger Things Season 3 in whatever the bald guy with the beard, I don't remember his name, but in his house there's like his rotary phone and taped onto it is his phone number. And so if you call it, there's like a pre-recorded message of him, like of him talking and stuff. And it's pretty cool.
Oh man. It's funny. Like it's the same thing with like How I Met Your Mother. Anytime they mention a website, you can punch in that website and it usually goes somewhere. Like Lillian Marshall Seldar Stuff.com is a real website.
Yeah, I have heard that.
But yeah, it just always makes me wonder, who are these people that are sitting around dialing any number that isn't a 555 number in a movie?
You know? Me.
I hear typing over on Colin's end. You're going to LillianMarshallSolderStuff.com, aren't you?
So am I.
I just had to make sure it worked.
Yeah, there's also whatever Barney's resume is. There's a website for that.
And, oh, yeah.
Like HireBarneyStinson.com or something like that. And yeah.
Right.
There's a few good ones.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Well, let's get to the climax of this movie. They cross their streams. They save the day. They kill the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, the whole 1, 2, 3, roast them. I have to say, that would be so sticky.
Yeah.
But how is it that Peter avoids getting covered in marshmallow? He's got like a little bit in his hair, but everyone else is just covered head to foot in marshmallow.
It's contractual obligation.
Yeah, it's Bill Murray.
Somehow, and I've never really understood this. I take it that like in the 80s, Bill Murray was something of, what's the word? He was like a sex icon. Like he was like the guy like ladies loved. And I don't really get it. I don't see it.
Yeah.
Why people or like why women would have been so drawn to him.
Yeah. Well, it's even like Dana says where it's like you're like talk show host or a game show host or I guess originally in the script it was you're a salesman and they changed it to the game show host thing, you know, and so it's just like, yeah, he's got kind of that. I mean, before Ghostbusters would have been like Stripes and Caddyshack, and so that's the Bill Murray that we're looking at, and Saturday Night Live, that's the Bill Murray that this isn't Groundhog Day Bill Murray yet, you know, because that was like 89, right? So this isn't Operation Dumbo Drop Bill Murray.
Yeah, like I feel like he's just, it's kind of one of those things, like he has to just maintain that cool factor. So he can't be drenched like Ray, like head to toe in slime and stuff. Like he has to maintain that air about him.
Well, and of course, he definitely doesn't get it like the villain of the movie. You know, when Peck is down on the ground and just gets like 1,000 gallons of marshmallow just dropped on him.
Yeah.
Like, that would still hurt. Like, that's a lot of, like, whatever that is, shaving cream or whatever they use. Like, that's
a lot of it to dump on someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My thing with, like, Walter Peck is he's not a bad guy. Like, he's... Like, obviously, his methods are bad, but, like, he literally did everything that, you know, he was supposed to. Like, he didn't really do anything wrong.
Oh, yeah, if Venkman hadn't been such a smartass and just showed him the thing, it wouldn't have escalated so quickly. But now that he's come back with cops and a warrant, I give you permission to shoot anyone!
Yeah.
I don't know,
Is crossing the streams a piss joke? Like, is that where that comes from? Or did, like, I don't know. I just remember hearing that, like, when I was a kid. Like, I don't know, maybe this is saying too much about me. But when I was a kid, I feel like little boys, you could get, like, three of you around the bowl, and you can all just go together.
Yeah.
And you'd always make the joke, like, don't cross the streams, because, you know, it's a massive mess, but...
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's the order that it has worked in. I don't think it was a piss joke first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it was because of this movie, it's now something that is known in our society as, that's a good piss joke. Don't cross the streams.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, the Ghostbusters save the day. We get the awkward kiss between Dana and Peter, and then the end. That is Ghostbusters. Now, Colin, Will, on IMDb, it scored 7.8 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 71, but Rotten Tomatoes liked it a lot more. It has 97% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 88%. But Colin, those are just numbers. Like, crossing the streams, hit us with some reviews.
All right. I'm going to start with a review from the Google review service. This is from Eduardo Marin, and it's just a list-based review, which I enjoy. He says, "Why it rocks. Creative idea about ghost exterminators. Our main characters have superb chemistry. Memorable theme song. Spectacular special effects. A lot of amusing dialogue. The ghost designs are awesome, especially on Slimer. The scene where the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man goes berserk in the third act was exciting, and his fate was interesting. The Ecto-1 car is another great iconic 80s movie car, aside from the DeLorean from Back to the Future, which was released the following year in 1985. Ghostbusters 2 was a decent sequel. The poster is one of the most iconic in film history. And then, in bad qualities, he just says, the reboot.
Oh. Oh, poor Answer the Call.
Oh, jeez.
Rotten Tomatoes user Grant M. gave the movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, there is nothing about Ghostbusters that isn't fantastic. Ivan Reitman is at the peak of his directorial powers, while Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and Harold Ramis sparkle with effortless chemistry. Sigourney Weaver lends strength and weight to the film as the female lead, and Rick Moranis steals every scene he appears in. Meanwhile, Elmer Bernstein's score continues to be underrated, see Dana's theme. It can be a little surprised why the characters and story left a lifelong impression on fans. The answer is its timeless charm. From the characters, the costume design, and New York as a setting, it is worth noting how little modern buildings feature in the film, from the opening with the library, the university campus, firehouse, and Dana's apartment building. Let's not forget the iconography of Ghostbusters. The logo, the equipment, and the car. Ecto-1 has arguably the greatest reveal of any car in film history.
Okay.
I don't know that we talked about Ecto-1 that much, but where does Ecto-1 rank in your guys' list of top cinematic vehicles?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the top three quintessential 80s cars is like Kit from Knight Rider, the DeLorean, and Ecto-1. And the Batmobile, I guess, because the Tim Burton, that was in the 80s too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is definitely up there. I don't know, though, whether if I was a billionaire or something like that and I started a collection of iconic cars, I don't know if Ecto-1 would be as high on my list.
I know it'd be high on mine. I think that's a really nice looking vehicle. My only problem with it is that it has to be illegal for non first responder vehicles to have blue and red sirens.
Well, does it have red? I thought it was only blue on that one. Well,
I know it's blue and red at first.
I don't know. Yeah, I thought it was only blue. I mean, I will say that when Ecto-1 shows up in the trailer for Ghostbusters Afterlife,
yeah,
like it definitely brought chills to me. It's like, oh yeah. And of course they have the fancy jump seat that pops out the side and everything like that, so
I mean,
yeah. It was great to see Ecto-1. You can't have a Ghostbusters movie without Ecto-1.
And then like the teaser poster with it like in the wheat field is really cool too. I love that.
Oh my god, I suddenly forget, with the Answer the Call movie, they have a slightly different Ecto-1, don't they?
Yeah.
Like it's an old hearse or something, I think, in that one. Whereas this is like an old-fashioned ambulance.
Yeah, I can look right now.
So maybe that's the problem everyone had. It wasn't actually a problem with changing the gender of all the main characters. Their real problem was that Ecto-1 didn't come back, right?
Yeah, it's like the picture I have, it's like a boxier car and the back is hearse-like.
Yeah,
but it's like, okay. It's like boxier, like the front is like a, well, let's see, I think it says the name on there. Yeah, it's a Cadillac.
Okay.
So I guess a Cadillac hearse is the Ecto-1 replacement.
Yeah.
Nice. All right, my next review is from Samuel L. He gives the movie 2.5 out of 5 stars and says, another movie that is massively overpraised. It wasn't particularly funny, and the plot and some of the characters were bizarre. The film took a bit of time to get going, the middle portion was more enjoyable, and then the ending was silly. The characters were largely likable, though the acting was decent. Some parts did manage to make me smile, and it does deserve praise for its originality. The visual effects don't hold up that well today, but the cinematography and soundtrack were fine.
Okay. I wasn't sure whether you would find something that was as low as 2.5.
Oh, just you wait.
Oh, okay.
Uh-oh.
Benjamin G. gave the movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, I love ghosts! Always preferred them over vampires, zombies, and werewolves. It was all thanks to this masterpiece and Danny Phantom.
Okay.
Melody Z. says, 5 out of 5 stars, a total classic, fit for kids 10+ and kids of all ages. Watch it every Halloween. Nothing comes close to the weird, wonderful, quirky, and timeless charm that makes up the cast. Who you gonna call? And then here's the master, the pièce de résistance of reviews. I always love it when I can find one that's just like absolutely bonkers. So here we go. From Google, Margaret Jensen says, "I did not like this film at all. The film was the slimiest film I have ever seen. The acting was juvenile. I would rather watch Casper. Stay Puft the Marshmallow Man was a bad guy, really. I can't stand Rick Moranis as one of the most annoying actors there is. The rest of the cast was all right, I guess. I like Sigourney Weaver. She is very pretty and a very good actress. She wasted her talent on this film. I'm glad that I didn't waste my money on the film when it was in the movie theater."
Okay.
All right.
Here's one question I have about like the whole Rick Moranis Sigourney Weaver thing. Does Dana Barrett own that dress that Zool wears? Because Lewis Tully is still in his blue shirt and khakis, but she suddenly changes into like this sexy, semi-transparent orange dress. So she gets all dolled up, but the Keymaster doesn't get dolled up.
Hmm. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
I feel like she must have owned it, and then Zool just wanted to be sexy.
Yeah.
Because there's something about maybe he has to like do the dirty with the Keymaster.
Yeah. But it didn't look very hard to convince the Keymaster once he showed up.
Right.
I don't know. Oh well. Okay. Is that it for reviews?
Alright, that's all I got for reviews.
Right on. So yeah, 70s from IMDb and 88 and 97 from Rotten Tomatoes. Colin, I'm going to go to you first because you seemed a little hesitant at the beginning. Where are you falling on Ghostbusters?
You know what? I'm going to echo a lot of the sentiments that people threw at one of my favorite movies, The Crow, a couple weeks ago or maybe a week ago. I don't know how far removed from that one as this time of recording. And even though there was no tragedy that I am aware of marring the filming of this production, I'm going to say that this movie isn't as good as people like to think it is.
Yeah.
I actually don't think it's that great a movie. But I hold absolutely zero nostalgia for it. And everybody I know who loves it is like, they watched it when they came out and it was like a big thing. And I mean, as much as I like the real Ghostbusters cartoon, even as a cartoon, it was probably like 15th on my cartoons list after like Ninja Turtles and all the other good stuff. So I mean, Ghostbusters to me is just it's not ever been something that's really clicked with me or caught my interest. Watching this movie this go around, I think it's just, I don't like any of the characters. Not one. That's not true. I like Rick Moranis. I like Lewis. But other than him, I don't like any of the Ghostbusters. I didn't find any of them, like, overly funny or interesting or... Yeah, I don't know. They just didn't do it for me, so... people are, like, super stoked about Ghostbusters Afterlife. I probably won't watch that movie until it's on Netflix. So that's kind of where I sit. I think Ghostbusters, to me, it's like a 50% movie. It's like I would never seek it out to watch it, but if it was on and people were watching it, I'd sit down and watch it.
Wow. Okay. Hot take from Colin.
Yeah. That's smoking.
Our viewership, our listenership is about to just take a steep decline.
Plummet. Plummet, yeah.
They'll be picketing. They'll be picketing outside Sean's house, being like, "Get rid of him! Get rid of him!"
You know, I don't know if I entirely disagree with you. I'll be perfectly honest. It has its moments, but it does drag in places a little bit more than I remember it. And even when I look at the difference between IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes ratings, I think 97% is ludicrous, right? Like that's a little over the top. I mean, Back to the Future is one of those movies that it has that iconic build of all these years of nostalgia, but that's one that I feel still holds up really well. Ghostbusters, you know, you've definitely made me realize that, wait a minute, yeah, Peter is a very unlikable character. As funny as Bill Murray is, and you know, this legendary status of Bill Murray, yeah, he's a misogynist, and now I'm wondering why he was carrying around a date rape drug, and you know, it is one of those situations where it's like, I can see where you're coming from. Now, I can't possibly give Ghostbusters a 50%, though. But I will say that I think IMDb is definitely more accurate than Rotten Tomatoes on this particular movie, is that I would be happy with like a mid-70s. I mean, it's iconic. It's a movie everyone should see at least once. You have to know what Ghostbusters is. But yeah, I don't know whether I'm as behind it as I used to be, just because although it's filled with great moments, overall, it's not as strong as I remember it being. So let's hope, though, that Will can bring all our listeners back to us. Let's close it out with Will. Bring up the mood a little bit, or don't. I mean, what do you think of Ghostbusters on this viewing of it? You say it's one that you watch yearly.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, you know, the Halloween movie. So it's the nostalgia there for me. You know, it's just so many great memories. But I do think that, you know, the high ratings and like the tens and the fives and the 97%, I don't think that that's accurate, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, nostalgia aside, like if it was my first time watching it, like forget everything I know about Ghostbusters, it's like high sevens, low eights.
Yeah,
it's got a lot of great moments, and I do think it still holds up. The effects don't hold up, if I'm going to be honest, but like the score, the world building, like the acting, like Dan Aykroyd is unreal. Like, I love Dan Aykroyd in this movie, and I agree there's definitely a lot of character flaws, but I definitely think the portrayal of these characters, you know, brought up the and, you know, kind of erased the flaws that were there. So
yeah,
that is my honest opinion. Low, high sevens, low eights. I'll put it at an 8.2, let's say.
An 8.2, yeah. Well, yeah, I know I can just sit there and marvel at someone like Rick Moranis in this movie.
Yeah.
And that is definitely, that's almost enough to get through this movie on its own, right? And then if you think that everyone else is kind of two-dimensional, I mean, at least you've got Lewis Tully to kind of pull you through any of the slow moments and all that sort
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's I get it. It's this is the definition of a movie that's clouded by nostalgia. It really is. It's amazing for what it did. You know, like Will mentioned the special effects. I'd say that all the ghost effects themselves are still really good. Mm-hmm. But like even having Dana's building on the edge of Central Park, it is so fake. Like it's so painted in. And so, like, some of those, they are really weak effects, but, I mean, overall, it holds up to an extent, but it is slow. Well, on that note, there we go! That is Ghostbusters! And that's our show for this week! Oh, boy, a big thank you to our special guest this week, Mr. Will Brisbane. Will, is there anything that you would like to promote? Where can people find you online? All that sort of stuff.
All right, so on Instagram, you can find me at will.brisbane. On Twitter, you can find me at willbrisbane. Hang on, I'm double-checking on that because I said it wrong the last time. Yep, at willbrisbane. And then on Facebook is the same thing, at willbrisbane.
Oh, you have a Facebook page now. That's new since last time you were here.
And I think
trying to sell some stuff on Marketplace, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And considering that it is now November 18th, if you're listening to this on the date of release, there's probably something else that you could promote that starts in just a couple of weeks.
Exactly. So me and Sean, it's pretty awesome. We're doing Elf the Musical at Festival Place here in Sherwood Park, put on by the Festival Players. And that runs from December 15th to 30th, if I'm not mistaken.
Something like that.
Yeah. And so tickets are already available. It's going to be super awesome, super high energy. And you get to see me and Sean, you know, do what we do best.
That's right. So if you're in the Northern Alberta region, you could come see that in December. Right on. Well, thank you.
I know I'll be there.
Right on. Well, thank you for joining us, Will.
Of course. Thanks for having me, guys.
If you like that show, oh boy, one thing you could really do is help us get some more earballs on this show. Come on. We need some more people listening. Just go out there and tell your friends. Say, hey, there's this podcast you might enjoy. Maybe you should check it out. Or if you want to go above and beyond and help us find a new audience, go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars if that option is available to you. It doesn't matter what you say in any reviews that you leave for us. It's not for our egos. But giving us 5 stars, it messes with the algorithms of these sites and just helps drive us up the charts and helps us get noticed. Or if you want to go above and beyond because you got a few extra bucks kicking around each month, well, why don't you join us on Patreon and become a producer of this show and get a shout out on the show, just like executive producer Joshua Blum. Just go over to patreon.com/IUsedToLikeThisOne and become part of our Patreon family.
And be sure to check out our website, www.IUsedToLikeThisOne.com. There you can find links to all of our podcast episodes as well as all our social media pages. We have Instagram, we have Facebook, we have Twitter. Go on there, give us some comments, give us some likes, give us some shares. Drop us a line at IUsedToLikeThisOne@gmail.com and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us talking about them on the show.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.
Thanks, Will.
Yay!
Yes, of course. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I'm
excited to come see you be a... You're playing the sun in Elf, Sean was saying.
Hell yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm pretty pumped.
Yeah, he just has to get his yay mom and dad are fighting timing down.
Yeah, that... Yeah, I know. Oh, my. And yeah, the first day was that I couldn't get the notes, and then I figured out the notes, and then I couldn't get the timing. But I mean, hopefully my one line in that song.
Yeah, he has one line in one of the songs that we've been working on, and
yes.
And he's got like a 5% success rate on it so far, so.
Yeah, I'm like one for like 30.
I'm
looking at that, but it's pretty tough.
I'm looking forward to actually starting on my song, so.
Yeah, that one's gonna be the funnest one in the show.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like I've got my solo moment coming up, you know. But we haven't got.
Hell yeah!
I'm excited. Yes. I get to do stage fighting this year. I'm excited for that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I get to.
You're the Macy's Santa. You get to fight Buddy.
Yeah. So yeah, we're gonna That's be getting a choreographed number.
Yeah. Nice.
Sweet.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, unlike something like Oklahoma, where it had to be like a nice serious fight, this is going to be a chance for some comedy. Yeah,
sweet. Totally. That's always fun.
I'm hoping that a sword fight using wrapping paper tubes will come out or something like that. That would be.
Right.
Guys should recreate the sword fight from The Princess Bride.
There you go.
Somehow in the Macy's.
Yeah, that's right.
That would actually be a cool suggestion.
I am not left-handed.